This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. This week, a report on Mexico. We look at how Mexican authorities are cracking down on migrants from Central America.
Como a eso de que faltaban unos 15.
They arrived at about 1:45, and it was still around 4 o'clock, and they were still beating us. They grabbed about 200 people, and about 80% of them were beaten or hit or kicked.
And the Mexican menu includes staples like tortillas and beans, but there are also some surprising delicacies.
Today I had some rice with grasshoppers, and they were very good.
You first need to get the peanuts, you get the salt and the bread.
Plus, music from Mexican-American singer Lila Downs.
Get cinnamon and banana, get cloves and oregano.
This is the World Vision Report. First, this hour's news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Most Americans probably don't think of Mexico as having its own illegal immigrant problem, but in 2006, Mexican authorities deported 250,000 Central Americans. They were passing through Mexico on their way to the U.S., but the immigration authorities in Mexico don't appear too interested in where they're headed, as long as they're heading out of the country. Our Mexico correspondent, Conrad Fox, says sometimes Mexican authorities use tough tactics to move immigrants out. He filed this report from Orizaba in southern Mexico.
It's 5 o'clock in the afternoon by the side of a railway line. As a freight train builds up steam in the distance, a group of ragged-looking men gather by the track. They're all Central Americans, mostly from Honduras, waiting to hop a northbound train that will get them closer to their final destination, the U.S. There are about 50 of them here. A few hours earlier, there were many more, but immigration officers, aided by local police, swooped down on the site and rounded them up.
La policía mexicana es una basura.
These two men escaped, but they're still shaking with fury at the memory.
Como a eso de que faltaban unos 15.
They arrived at about 1:45, and it was still around 4 o'clock, and they were still beating us. They grabbed about 200 people, and about 80% of them were beaten or hit or kicked. They sprayed pepper in this one guy's eye and left him blind.
Look, I've got the marks here where they handcuffed me. They took them off because they were hurting, and when they removed them, I jumped out of the truck. I walked 1.5 hours to get back here. I'm sweating, I'm starving. They beat me, they stole my belt, my money I was going to buy food with. I'm so hungry.
Police and immigration agents have been cracking down and deporting illegal immigrants like these. But neighbors here say the agents' methods are far from humane. This young woman, who asked not to be identified, volunteers at a local church which feeds migrants. She recalls an episode 5 months ago when police cornered migrants on a nearby bridge.
They said, if they don't jump, they were going to beat them up. So they jumped. And the first guy, well, everyone else landed on top of him, and he was really hurt. I don't know why they do this. The migrants only ever run. We've never seen them fight back.
The local office of the Mexican government's migration department coordinated the railway operation. But no one there would talk on tape at all, let alone answer the charges of abuse. This woman asked for the recorder to be turned off. In Mexico City, the central office of the department did not respond to her request for an interview for this story. Last year, the U.S. State Department published a report lambasting Mexican authorities for their treatment of Central American migrants. In response, the department pointed to a 2-year-old program designed to improve its human rights record. But many experts say the effort hasn't been enough.
We can't go around saying, hey, Bush, treat Mexican immigrants well, when we're beating migrants from the south with sticks.
Rodolfo Casillas is an immigration policy researcher at Flaxo, a public policy think tank in Mexico City. He was part of a coalition of academics and migrant advocacy groups that recently presented a report to the UN accusing Mexican immigration officials of, quote, abusing their position to mistreat and take advantage of migrants. The problem, he says, is widespread.
De mayo del año pasado a abril de este, entrevisté a 1,000 Centroamericanos.
Between May of last year and April of this year, I interviewed 1,000 Central Americans. And of those 1,000, they reported 1,600 separate incidents of abuse or human rights violations, stealing their clothes, stealing their money, physical violence, in the case of women, sexual violence.
Back at the train tracks in Orizaba, tempers have cooled. A neighbor offers coffee and bread to the migrants milling around. They all agree the further north you go in Mexico, the less abusive police and immigration officials seem to be. But the best, says Wilfredo Filiu, are in the U.S.
No, la policía de los Estados Unidos es bien respetuosa. No, nunca enfrente.
U.S. police are very respectful. We never face this there. It's a different kind of treatment from the police and from immigration. They understand what humanity is, but these, no. The Mexican police are complete animals.
In a few hours, the migrants will be hopping another train north. They'll still have to contend with cold, hunger, exhaustion, and the constant danger of falling under the train. But for now, they seem glad to have escaped Mexico's migration authorities. This time. For the World Vision Report, I'm Conrad Fox in Orizaba, Mexico.
Just ahead, you can hear the background to this story and Conrad Fox's Reporter's Notebook. But first, we've just heard about people traveling through Mexico to get to the U.S. But many Americans are heading to Mexico for vacation. It's a popular tourist destination. American visitors probably assume their tourist dollars are boosting the economy in Mexico. But that's not always the case. I spoke with Jonathan Tortlow, director of National Geographic's Center for Sustainable Destinations.
A lot of the money sometimes suffers from what they call leakage, meaning it leaks right back out of the country where you think you're spending it, because it may be spent on companies that are owned outside of Mexico. If you go with a tour operation, a lot of that money may stay in the U.S. and so on. And particularly things like food and supplies, they may not get that locally at all, and that does not support local agriculture. Plus, it may give you more boring food. So it can really vary a lot from one company to another, and one easy way to begin looking at that is seeing if the company has any stated policy of supporting local people, the local economy, local farmers, and so on.
Couldn't you make an argument that at least they're hiring housekeepers, waitresses, that the locals are being hired and therefore they are benefiting the community?
Well, you can make that argument, and it's true as far as it goes. But one of the next questions I would ask is, do you have a program for training local people to move up in the hierarchy? There was a national leader in Belize once who said he didn't want to preside over a nation of waitresses and busboys. So if the hotel has a program to promote and train local people to learn more about the business, move up in the hierarchy, that's a good sign. If everybody in management is from some other country, that's a warning sign.
Let's say I want to go take a typical vacation to Cancun or Acapulco. It takes just a few hours flying. And I really want different options in tourism. I want to make sure my dollars are helping the local economy. What tips would you give me?
Well, I think my first tip would be don't go to Cancun or Acapulco. go somewhere else. And Mexico is, I think, an incredibly underrated country by people north of the border, because they kind of have an image that's distorted by the border issues and all that sort of thing. But this is one of the most beautiful countries in the world. It has a rich history. It has incredible flora and fauna that you can't see here. It's got a distinctive cuisine on a global scale. There's wonderful stuff to do and see in Mexico. You go to Cancun, you're not seeing Mexico. You're seeing what someone called Gringolandia there. But there's still loads and loads of authentic places in Mexico, whether it's on the coast or inland, historic towns and so forth. And that's where the real experiences are.
Jonathan Tortlow, thank you so much for joining us today.
You bet.
That was Jonathan Tortlow, director of National Geographic's Center for Sustainable Destinations. He spoke to us from his office in Washington, D.C.
En una noche de luna, Naila lloraba.
Earlier, we heard Conrad Fox's story about the abuse that migrants from Central America sometimes encounter as they pass through Mexico. Conrad now takes us behind the story, with this reporter's notebook.
Behind a piece of tin sheeting on a side street, a dozen or so migrants huddle in the dark. Tomorrow, they'll try to jump onto a northbound train. So they spend the night here, just a few feet from the train tracks. They look like desperados at first sight, but when you get to know them, they seem more like an extended family. A couple of girls in the group make tomato tacos, which they serve to the others. For many, it's the only thing they'll eat today. The younger ones laugh and dance to the sound of a distant stereo. There's 22-year-old Hebert from Honduras, who's going to write a book about his trip. And there's 50-something Filiberto, a hardened, sunburnt veteran of this route. He's also from Honduras and has seen some terrible things on these journeys, like exhausted companions falling under the wheels of trains. But the jolly wrinkles around his eyes and his soft voice hide it all. He's kind of a mentor to the younger ones. But Filiberto has someone special to look out for on this trip. He's traveling with his 17-year-old daughter. He tried to talk her out of it, but she insisted on coming. She wanted to see her mother, who lives in the U.S. The next day at the train depot, about 150 migrants wait for a train. One starts up as they gather by the tracks, stretching, arranging backpacks. There's a tense atmosphere now as the train builds up steam. "Where's Filiberto?" Hebert, the 22-year-old, asks, with concern. There he is, strolling casually towards us, his daughter beside him. The train is almost upon us now, and suddenly it's every man for himself. Without warning, Hebert shakes my hand and is off running. Others stream past, racing for the ladders attached to the ends of the cars. In the fray, they bump each other to grab a free spot. Hebert swings himself up, just as a signpost skims past his head. Filiberto hoists his daughter up onto a ladder as it passes by them and runs alongside her. She's grabbed the lowest rung, but then one hand slips and her legs swing wildly under the carriage. Her father still holds the hem of her t-shirt, trying to keep her legs away from danger, but the train is now moving faster than he can run. The shirt stretches and stretches. She tries to hold onto the ladder, but she's losing her grip. "Let go," her father cries, and then she falls. With one determined movement, he swings her away from the wheels of the train. They get up again, running together alongside it, but it's going too fast. The last car sails past, just out of reach. Yet, they continue to run, and now there's no one else left on the tracks except them, running hand in hand behind a train they'll never catch.
That was the World Vision Report's Mexico correspondent, Conrad Fox. If you'd like to see a dramatic photo of this incident, go to our website, worldvisionreport.org. Coming up, Latinos who make the long trek across the border to the U.S. run the risk of dying in the desert from dehydration. But a group of pilots is parachuting water bottles over the desert to help save their lives. That's just ahead on the World Vision Report. Stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. Each year, several hundred migrants die making their way across the U.S.-Mexico border. Most of them succumb to heat stroke and dehydration. But there's an organization that helps these immigrants survive their journey. Paisanos al Rescate, or Countrymen to the Rescue, drop bottles of water from airplanes to those crossing the desert below. Janet Heimlich rode along on a flight from Texas. She has this report from El Paso.
On this already hot morning, Armando Alarcón and his pilot, Harold Aguirre, jump into their Cessna four-seater plane in El Paso and take off. The Cessna flies over the desert in New Mexico, just north of the Mexican border. Its sand, sagebrush, and extinct volcanoes seem to stretch out forever. Wearing in-flight headsets, Alarcón points to a long dirt road down below that separates the United States from Mexico. Up ahead is a small Mexican town called Las Chepas.
This area out here where the people cross and they head north, as you can see, it's just so vast. It's about a 50-mile walk up to damming the closest little town.
Alarcón and Aguirre are scanning the desert looking for those migrants. If they see any, they'll reach into the back seat, grab some bottles of water, one bottle per person, and toss them out of the plane's tiny window. Each bottle makes its way to the ground slowly without breaking, thanks to a small parachute that's attached to it.
We circle around when we drop it. You know, they look at the bottle, they, you know, maybe a little confused at first, but everybody that we've dropped to goes, walks out and walks to it.
Alarcón started his organization, Paisanos al Rescate, or Countrymen to the Rescue, 1 year ago. On the ground at the El Paso airport where he flies from, Alarcón points to the message on one of the water bottles.
We have this 2-liter water, bottle of water with our label on it. And if somebody needs to be rescued, they lie down. If they don't need to be rescued, they just put a hand up in the air.
The bottles also have a lot of other information, the symptoms of dehydration, the phone number of Mexican consulates, and a request to not leave the bottle in the desert. Alarcón says if someone does give the need help signal and lies down, he alerts the U.S. Border Patrol.
They have the resources. They have the helicopters. They can land. They can, you know, their Borstar teams, the Border Patrol search and rescue teams, could actually be there within minutes, rescue the people and keep them from dying. And by calling the Border Patrol, yeah, they'll get deported, but God, they're going to go home alive and not in a box.
So far, Alarcón and his group of a dozen volunteer pilots have not needed to make that phone call. The flights go out every weekend, from March until the fall. Each weekend, the group spends about $1,500, all from individual donations. Alarcón sees nothing wrong with people crossing into the U.S. illegally. He maintains most migrants only want to stay in the States temporarily to make money they can't make in Mexico. City. That seems to be the case with some migrants heading north from the town of Palomas, Mexico, about 80 miles west of El Paso. Palomas is a small, dusty border town that's become a gathering place for those getting ready to cross. They come here from all parts of Mexico, then take a rickety bus to Las Chepas, about 20 miles away, and simply walk through an opening in a fence. One man ready to embark on this journey is a 23-year-old who calls himself Martin.
¿Qué le diré? Sí, tengo preocupación porque también tengo familia.
What can I tell you? Yeah, I'm worried because I already have a family. We've got to try because things are bad for our families and we don't want to suffer anymore.
Martin is dressed in a t-shirt and cutoffs and wears a baseball cap. He's carrying a small backpack with enough food and water to last a couple days. Martin says if he makes it, he hopes to work in the States for 2 to 3 years before returning home to his wife and child.
So I think I'll be there for a good while, to earn some good money, so that I can put it towards something that can sustain my family. A little business.
Countrymen to the Rescue does have its critics. Some say the group just helps attract more illegal immigrants to the States, which Alarcón denies. On the other side of the debate, migrant advocates say the group, which isn't politically active, should do more to fight for immigrant civil rights. But Alarcón believes in what he does.
Well, I mean, you're out there, you're contributing to humanity. You're doing something good. And it all adds up.
Yeah. Alarcón says he plans to expand Countrymen to the Rescue. He envisions having 3 planes based in Texas, New Mexico, and California. He says these planes would have telephoto cameras installed under their bellies to better spot people making the long, hot sojourn north. For the World Vision Report, I'm Janet Heimlich in El Paso.
For people concerned about the plight of those living in the developing world, there are many ways to make a difference. Some put a check in an envelope and send it to their favorite charity. Others, like the pilots we've just heard from, find a way to do something more concrete. Mona Purdy is one of those people. When Mona went to Guatemala to run in a race, she had no idea the trip would be life-changing. But when Mona saw Guatemalan children walking around without shoes, she knew she had to do something. Back home in Chicago, Mona started collecting shoes, and she now runs an organization called Share Your Soles. Kids from the Windy City volunteer at her warehouse, cleaning and restoring shoes for their new owners. Many of those new owners are in Mexico. Mona delivers shoes there a dozen times a year. Mona Purdy joins us as part of our recurring series, The Power of One.
Prior to the adult run, the kids had a small kids run, and I noticed the kids weren't wearing shoes. But what was stranger is I found out they had painted hot tar on the bottom of their bare feet because they didn't have shoes to run on a rock road. And the images of that affected me to the point that I'm the whole way home kept thinking of that song Diana Ross sings. Reach out and touch somebody's hand. Make this world a better place if you can. If you see an old man on the street, just remember his shoes may one day fit your feet. And I just was horrified because I have three kids that I've never wanted for a thing.
What did you do from there?
I went around and asked people and told them what I'd seen.
Mm-hmm.
And with my big mouth, I ended up with 5,000. And
5,000 shoes?
Pairs of shoes.
So you go back from that one trip to Guatemala and you get this vision for starting the whole organization called Share Your Souls.
Correct.
What does this organization do now?
We inspire kids here that are blessed with abundance to share with those who have so little in third and fourth world countries. And we ship gently worn shoes to over 30 locations worldwide so kids, number one, can go to school, so it protects their feet from disease, amputation, and something that we don't think of here because we take for granted, self-esteem and choice.
How come you're sending used shoes instead of new shoes?
Where I go, new shoes are danger. New shoes are danger. Someone might mug a kid, kill him, rape him to sell the shoes.
You've made quite a few trips to Mexico. You ship lots of shoes there.
Correct.
Tell us a little about your work there.
First time I knew Mexico was poor was in the garbage dump in Tijuana. Well, I went down there and these kids had like scraps of fabric on and no shoes. I left there devastated. So this dumpy hotel I was staying at across the border, I was hanging my head and the busboy came up to me and he said, you know, what's wrong? Did something happen? And I told him where I'd been. He goes, why would you go there? The people in Mexico don't go there. You know, that's a bad neighborhood you went to. And I said, if I paid you, will you take me back? And he said, yeah, you give me $50. So he took me and we went down there. Well, when we pulled in, they surrounded us with sticks. And I thought, I'm going to die right now. The next thing I know, he gets out of the car and I see these people hugging him. And he got back in the car. And I said, what just happened? Because he had been gone for maybe 10 minutes. It seemed like hours. And he looks at me and he goes, I grew up here. And he said, my father used to garbage pick and recycle things so I could go to school because I was one of these kids that didn't have shoes. So that day, you know, when you think you can't get any more deeper involved in what you do, My life changed again that day. And now I go to the same place. Often we ship to Mexico 15 times a year, but we have to smuggle across the border because it's illegal to bring you shoes because so many people have taken goods down there and then sold them to these people.
Mm. So how many shoes do you think you've delivered to Mexico so far?
I haven't counted because there's about 8 of us that go to outside of Guadalajara, outside of Puerto Vallarta, outside of Mexico City, outside of Acapulco. And it's funny, I involved one busboy. And now there's close to 50 of us that are involved in this now.
And you've seen these kids receive their new shoes. What is the scene like when the kids and the shoes connect?
You would think I bought them a house. I've seen kids hug the shoes. I've seen them run away with them. And some of them want to know what they have to do to keep the shoes. Because I know other people have given them things in exchange for whatever, whatever. But we hug them and tell them that they are theirs for as long as they want to keep them.
It sounds like this really energizes you.
Oh, it does. And you know, sometimes when I get caught up in the material world here, I send myself to Haiti or Tijuana to the garbage dump and remind myself why I do this. Because you know what? When we're blessed here with so much and we do something for someone else and make their day, it really does make our day.
All right. Mona Purdy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Peggy.
Mona Purdy is founder of Share Your Souls, a nonprofit organization sending used shoes to needy children around the world.
Living in a material world, and I am a material girl. You know that we are living in a material world, and I am a material.
With so many people leaving Mexico to look for work in the U.S., the communities left behind often struggle to survive. But one town in central Mexico isn't just surviving, it's thriving. That's despite the fact that half the people from the town currently live in the United States, and almost all of them have worked in the U.S., at least for a while. The town of El Alberto has triumphed over poverty and the loss of its labor force by appealing to the honor of its townspeople, Jordana Gustafson reports.
Every man who leaves El Alberto to work in the U.S. knows he will one day be called home. For 29-year-old Juan Jeronimo, who left town for Salt Lake City, Utah, 13 years ago, the call came earlier this year.
Por medio de mi familia, ellos hablamos.
I found out through my family. They called me and told me to work. And they decide. I don't get to decide if I want to come and work.
In September, Jeronimo and his wife packed up their pickup truck and their two American-born children, left their home and a steady job, and drove back to their small town in the central Mexican state of Hidalgo.
I like to serve my town, and I should do so because I'm from here.
Jeronimo is a willing participant in a modernized version of a community model called Cargos, a system found in indigenous communities across Mexico. It compels citizens to fulfill a year of community service when they're called to do so by town elders. Lafayette College anthropologist Dan Bauer has spent years studying this model in an indigenous community nearby.
The system of Cargos is a set of obligations that people have to their community. The people who fail to commit their energies to their cargos are regarded as people who are not community spirited and don't deserve a lot of respect within the community.
It's this respect that has kept the system of cargos in place for hundreds of years. In El Alberto today, it lessens the negative effects of heavy migration to the U.S.
I've seen some small towns that started off with maybe a population of 400 or 500 people who are now down to basically old people and their grandkids who are living with the old people.
But not El Alberto. Each year, more than 100 men and their families return home from their jobs in the U.S. They come whether they live just over the border in Arizona or in New York, and they come whether they've been gone 2 years or 20. They do volunteer work in the town's schools and in public works. School buildings have fresh coats of paint, front yards have potted plants and flowers, and the main road through town is flat and smooth. There's another community project that many volunteers take part in, a brand new ecological park, which attracts tourists from all over Mexico, and it generates revenue. Jeronimo's volunteer job here at the park is nothing like working construction in Salt Lake. Near midnight, he's waiting in a grass clearing by the river. Jeronimo and 70 others have scaled the towering cliffs of a sacred canyon in the middle of the park. They've placed hundreds of torches here. And every Saturday night, they light them for the tourists.
Prepárense.
But the park also gives them the chance to experience something more sobering, a night hike that simulates the treacherous experience of crossing the border illegally. It provides a bit of a thrill, with fake Border Patrol agents and screaming sirens, but it also helps hikers understand the dangerous trek many of their relatives have made. The hike's leader, Pancho, says the park and hike have jump-started El Alberto's economy.
We hope the next generations will stay here, that we've alleviated immigration a bit.
The illegal crossing is something most of the people who work here have actually done. It's also something Jeronimo and his wife will do when they return to Utah at the end of the year. Jeronimo has no plans to live permanently in El Alberto again, now that he's put down roots in the U.S. So why would he sacrifice a year of good pay in Utah to work for free in his hometown? And why would he risk deportation and possibly his life when he leaves El Alberto again?
Because if we don't come back to work, it's like we're renouncing the town.
Fulfilling his cargo is a matter of honor. For the World Vision Report, I'm Jordana Gustafson in El Alberto, Mexico.
There are hundreds of thousands of street children in Mexico City. On a recent trip there, aid worker Carrie Costanza came to know one of them quite well. She describes her encounter with a young man in this aid worker diary.
It's rush hour in Mexico City, and I'm preparing to make a mad dash across a busy street. Horns are blaring, cars and motorcycles whiz by. Suddenly, a red light stops the action. It's my turn to step into the wide boulevard. But I know the red lights here don't last long. Can I make it? 16-year-old Jesus watches me, clearly anxious. Then he makes his move. He strides into the busy intersection and puts his hands out to stop traffic. The gringa crosses safely. Jesus knows the streets well. He lives on them. The first time I visit him in the park where he sleeps, it is late at night. I ask him about his scarred face, with red and raw cheeks and lips. My mother left a small stove unattended, he explains. Somehow I got burned. My mother told me Jesus saved me. He goes on. I wanted to be a priest, but then I met Angelica. The other children listening to our conversation burst into laughter. Jesus and Angelica have a child together with another on the way. I ask why he's here in the park and not with her. Jesus explains that she lives with her grandfather who forbids the two to marry. He wants to kill me, he says. Jesus' own family history is as thorny as the new family he is creating. Two siblings live with him in the park. Their mother is in jail. He doesn't know his father. Like many street kids here, Jesus sniffs Activo, a cheap paint thinner, to get high and to forget about his problems. His only friends are a handful of other street children and the workers at a nearby children's center who take the kids on regular outings. I go along on one occasion to see the latest Star Wars movie. As we enter the theater, Jesus is worried that I'll trip down the stairs. He points out the small, evenly spaced bulbs that light the way. As I start down the steps, he grabs my hand in the darkness and leads me to the front row. During the film, Jesus offers to share his popcorn with me. Occasionally, he smiles over at me, checking to make sure I'm enjoying myself. I am. In my time with Jesus, I got to see him not as the object of someone's wrath or pity, but as a bit of a hero. I think he took pride in the small ways in which he took care of me, from street child to Luke Skywalker, if only for a day.
That was aid worker Carrie Costanza. Coming up after the break, music from a singer with roots on both sides of the border. You're listening to the World Vision Report. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. We're going to bring you the music of Mexican-American singer Lila Downs a little bit later in the show. But right now, we want you to answer this question. What would it take to get you to eat a bug? A Mexican biologist says insects are a good source of nutrition for the world's poor. But she's not suggesting anything she wouldn't eat herself. In fact, in Mexico, a number of insects are valued as gourmet delicacies. We asked reporter Peter Aronson, who's a strict vegetarian, to swoop in for a closer look.
Just mention bugs and some people get the heebie-jeebies, but suggest sitting down and eating a plateful of them and the reaction might be near universal disgust. Yet the idea doesn't scare Professor Julieta Ramos Elordui, a biologist at Mexico's National Autonomous University. She loves bugs. She's been studying edible and medicinal insects for a quarter of a century, and as she's happy to explain, bugs have a lot going for them as a food source.
Insects have a great potential for relieving hunger and malnutrition in the world. First of all, because they're so numerous, and also because they have a very high nutritional value. They're basically made of proteins.
Ramos Elordui sees bugs not as a replacement for meat or fish, but as a complement to them. The idea of munching on creepy crawlies isn't an idea the professor hatched in her laboratory, though. Insects are eaten in many parts of Africa and Asia, and here in Mexico, where there are 500 known edible species, the practice of eating insects dates back to pre-Hispanic times.
Escamoles and eggs were given as a tribute to the emperor, Moctezuma. In fact, every town had to bring him a certain quantity.
At La Fonda de Don Chon restaurant in downtown Mexico City, Chef Fortino Rojas Contreras would probably laugh if you complained about a fly in your soup. He's famous for his pre-Hispanic cuisine. Today's menu includes armadillo, venison, and yes, lots of bugs. Grasshoppers with guacamole, ant eggs in a butter sauce. Grub tacos made with thick, yellowish, worm-like larvae are a particular delicacy. Chef Rojas shows me a couple of plastic bags.
Este mosquito se supone que tiene vitaminas, vitamina
B. This mosquito is supposed to have vitamin C, vitamin B. It has iron, phosphorus, and it has fats. This is tastier. Normally people here ask, what's this, a shrimp croquette? And they eat it. Once they've tried it, they say, it was delicious. And I say, yes, but you were eating mosquito eggs.
I decide to buzz over to Los Danzantes, a trendy Mexico City bistro, to see if I can catch some bug eaters in the act.
Buenas tardes. What did you order today?
Today I had some rice with grasshoppers, and for second plate I had ant eggs. They were very good.
And why would you order insects?
Well, I don't think of it as insects. I think of it as a food, and their taste was great.
They don't look like grasshoppers. They look like rice with something else, but not exactly rice. Yeah,
you can't see. I mean, grasshopper
you can't
there
see it. That's why
jumping all over your
plate. No, at all. No, they are like dead, and they're like in little pieces, very small pieces. So you don't really see that you are eating grasshoppers.
It's great. You should try it. Don't think about where it comes from. Just give it a try.
Yeah, I'm not all that hungry at the moment, but but thanks very much.
I have to admit that the spicy fettuccine with grasshoppers looks tempting, but at $17 a plate, the price is a bit steep. And those ant eggs are almost as expensive as caviar. So how's this kind of food going to benefit the world's poor? Professor Ramos Elordui says just because people are willing to pay high prices for edible insects doesn't mean they can't be had cheaply as well. She imagines that poor people could easily cultivate their own bugs.
There are other bugs that are omnivores that you can cultivate anywhere, feeding them garbage. This can be done in covered boxes.
On farms, she says, so-called pests, such as locusts, can be collected and eaten, providing another source of protein. Ramos Elordui laments that most people don't recognize insects' value as a food source.
We have within our reach a source of animal protein whose requirements for cultivating it are low. The care needed is relatively simple, and yet we're not taking advantage of it.
The problem, as Ramos Elordui sees it, is that in modern urban society, bugs have an image problem. But where many people see something icky, she sees perfection and lunch. For the World Vision Report, I'm Peter Aronson in Mexico City.
You can see a photo of some edible bugs at our website, worldvisionreport.org. Over the past 15 years, no state has seen a sharper rise in the number of Latino immigrants than North Carolina. Some of these immigrants have become U.S. citizens or permanent residents. But most are in North Carolina illegally, including children who have grown up there and will be graduating from high school this spring. North Carolina, like all states, allows undocumented children a publicly funded high school education, but that's not the case with most public universities. In North Carolina, as in most states, illegal immigrants are not allowed the benefits of in-state tuition. Many Americans think that's only fair, that students who are here illegally should not be rewarded for violating U.S. immigration laws. Still, some of these immigrants see college as their ticket out of poverty, and they dream of getting a degree. One of them is a young man from Mexico named Luis. Journalist Paul Cuadros, Luis's soccer coach, brings us this portrait.
Luis is 17 years old, tall with a muscular build and a gift for controlling a soccer ball. He is a fierce competitor on the soccer field and off. For the past several years, I have coached Luis's high school soccer team. Most of the kids on the team are Latinos. Some are here legally, but some, like Luis, are not. Luis, who's a star student, has bigger dreams than a job at the local chicken processing plant.
I'm planning to go into a four-year college,
Well, those are my plans, but I don't know if they will accept me because I'm not a legal citizen in the U.S. So I'm not sure if I'm going to accomplish my plans or not.
Some private North Carolina colleges will not accept undocumented students. And like most state universities across the country, North Carolina schools don't grant the benefit of in-state tuition to illegal immigrants.
Are there other kids in your situation?
Yeah, there are many kids in my situation. I mean, there are just a few of them that have papers, but the rest of them don't. So they're just planning on finishing high school and start working right after high school.
In Luis's community, many Latino kids drop out of school and start working at the chicken plant.
I'll try my best not to end up like that. I prefer not to think about it.
Even though Luis faces this challenge, his future is already brighter than it would have been back in Mexico, where he was born, and where his chances of breaking free from poverty were slim.
In Mexico, if you are poor, you're poor, man. Sometimes you don't even have a food to eat. And right here, I mean, even though you're poor, you always have food, you know?
It was that kind of extreme poverty that compelled Luis's father to leave the family and come to the United States. Back in Mexico, after 4 years of not seeing his dad, Luis decided to cross the border alone. He was only 12 years old. At night, in the desert, Luis never forgot his father.
I mean, every moment I was thinking about my dad. I didn't thought about death. I didn't think about anything else but my dad.
Finally, after 1,600 miles, Luis and his father were reunited.
And that moment, oh my God, that's unforgettable. When I saw him, I just went over there and hugged him. He hugged me too, and we started crying. We stand there like for, I don't know how many, it was a long time. I didn't know what to say, he didn't know what to say neither.
Like many undocumented children, Luis didn't come to get a job or find a better life. He came just to be with his dad. But today he is facing the consequences of that decision.
At that time I didn't know how illegal it was, but I didn't care either, so I would have done it anyways.
It has been more than a year since Luis told me that. Since then he's graduated from high school, and he's been through some tough breaks. A knee injury cost him an athletic scholarship and his chance to go to college for free. So today he works as an iron welder, six stories high on construction sites in Virginia.
I have to work like 60, 70 hours to get like a pretty good check. I like getting the big checks. What I don't like is spending that much time working and not enjoying my family, my friends. So that's why I decided to try to get into college so that I can actually have a career and that I don't have to work that many hours to get that check.
Luis has decided to apply to a local university that accepts undocumented students. Under the law, these students are charged out-of-state tuition. But Luis has been saving his money from his construction job, and the school is more affordable than other universities, so he thinks he can make it work. Luis is interested in studying construction management. We sit in the student lounge before his big interview with the program director.
Someday I would actually like to open my own iron company, which is one of my dreams, to one day have my own company and be able to help my dad, my family, my whole family.
A couple of hours later, Luis has finished his tour of the school and his interview with the program director. He's excited.
I'm definitely going to graduate from this university. They give me the opportunity to attend this school. So,
while lawmakers continue to debate what benefits illegal immigrants should be entitled to, Luis just wants to get a good education. As he puts it, he wants to be the one with the blueprints, not the blowtorch, in his hands.
Journalist Paul Quadros is based in North Carolina. His book about the high school soccer team he coaches is called A Home in the Field.
Entre copa y copa se acabó mi vida. Llorando borracha tu perfido amor. Como cuesta lágrimas una traición. Traigo penas en el alma.
For years, singer Lila Downs has bridged the cultural gap between Mexico and the United States. Lila was born in the southern Mexican state of Oaxaca to a Mexican Indian mother and a Scottish American father. As a child, she lived between homes in the mountains of Oaxaca and Minneapolis, Minnesota, where her father was a professor. Lila still calls both countries home, and her music crosses both borders. Lila Downs spoke to us from New York City. She told us that her childhood was a little unusual.
Well, I really grew up always crossing the border, you know. One year, since I was born. So I was very fortunate, but that was also a challenge, you know, kind of feeling like you didn't belong. You know, people ask you, well, where are you from? What do you, you know, that's the constant question. And feeling like you're from three different things, it was always a long story.
Three different things being American, Indian, and Mexican?
Yes.
And so has this influenced your music, Lila?
Definitely. Kind of trying to bridge those cultures, kind of trying to bring people together, you know, people from the U.S. who sometimes didn't know very much about Mexican cultures, you know, the diversity that we have. And also in Mexico, a lot of ignorance about what it means to be North American, you know, all we are is eat hot dogs and hamburgers.
Is that what they think?
Yeah.
You know, probably the biggest issue that comes to mind when Americans think about Mexico is immigration. And I'm sure you've looked at immigration from the perspective of both sides of the border. I'm wondering if you've written any music about this thorny issue.
You know, I was working in Oaxaca at one point, and these people would come into the store who had worked in the U.S. and had crossed the border. And one time a man came and asked me to translate this death certificate because his son had died in the intent of crossing the border. And I wrote a song about this incident called Ofrenda, which is on our first album called Sandunga.
En el camino pa'l norte, un tecolote me habló. Me dijo, muchacho de nube, ¿por dónde dejaste tu amor?
And what do you say in the song?
It's dedicated to those people who have passed. And the lyrics speak about, well, when I die, please send back my body to the patron saint of my pueblo, of my town, of my village, and dedicate my death to him, because all I was trying to do is work for my people.
Let's turn to some of your lighter subjects, like your song about cooking. Now, the words to this song we're about to play describe a recipe for mole sauce. Yeah. Let's play a little of that.
You first need to get the peanuts. You get the salt and the bread. You grind and you fry the chilies. You boil the chocolate. Get cinnamon and banana. Get cloves and oregano. Get thyme and the blackest. You grind it in Mexico. Oh yeah. Grind it. Grind it.
Is this song really about mole sauce, or is there something more to it?
Yeah. Well, it's really, you know, dedicated to those amazing women that cook. There's this cook called Abigail Mendoza, and she's from the Valley of Oaxaca, and she does the mole in the old way. Meaning she grinds all the elements, the chiles and the spices and the fruit and everything on the stone. And then, of course, the mole has a very particular flavor.
Now, Lila, you married an American musician, and you still live part of the time in the U.S. You're in New York now, but part of the time you're home in Oaxaca. So where That's do right. you consider home?
Well, really, both places are home, and I guess that I'm more rooted in Oaxaca in the sense that it's more of a spiritual center for me. But then for me, it's a challenge to bring Anglo audiences, especially to Latin, I guess, forms of aesthetic. And sometimes, you know, Anglos have this vision that that we are just these dramatic people, which is partly true. but that's what's beautiful about the culture. And what I'm trying to do in our songs is to make people feel that somehow, to relate, even though you can't speak the language. It's really cool to try and understand those differences and not turn your back on them.
Lila Downs, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Borrachita de tequila llevo siempre el alma mía.
Lila Downs is an award-winning world music artist. Her latest album is called La Cantina. She joined us from New York City. That brings us to the end of our show this week. You can find out more about the program and where to find us at our website, worldvisionreport.org. You can listen to the show there, or you can podcast it if you want to take us with you. Our radio team includes Beverly Abel, Doug Boyles, Mark Bandy, Chris Darden, Cynthia Graber, Lita Hartman, Diane Toomey, and I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. Thanks for listening.
This program was made possible in part by the PRX Reversioning Project. The public radio exchange is at prx.org. And National Endowment for the Arts. A great nation deserves great art.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.